Seneca Podcast, weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined this week by the doubtlessly somewhat bewildered Jeremy Goldhorn, who has relocated to the American South, where he's conducting anthropological work. How are you, Jeremy? I understand that you're studying the subculture of NASCAR racing. Is that correct?
I'm doing fine. You know, you're such a prejudiced Yankee kind of person.
I know.
I'm living in the Athens of the South, you know.
Yeah. Okay, observation of the week.
Observation of the week, the springtime in Nashville is beautiful.
Oh, come on. We need something, you know, cultural or political.
Have you spotted Elvis yet?
Here, I got one for you. I mean, do people give a fuck about China?
Most people don't.
Okay.
I mean... One thing I have realized about the United States is that it's a pretty inward-looking country. I mean, many people are not really aware of countries outside the United States. And a little bit like China, everywhere else is just like, go why, you know?
It's right. Kind
of like...
Yeah. There's jungle and white
people who sort of think they have something in common with me because they've been to Argentina and I'm a foreigner, you know.
I've been to Argentina. Right. Yeah. Jim Fallows is on a panel with me the other day down in Shanghai at NYU there. And he said something so funny. He said, I'm going to see if I get this quote correctly. He said, the relative indifference of Americans is one of the greatest factors contributing to world stability today. The relative indifference of Americans to China is one of the
yeah.
Okay, so we're getting some assent here in the room. Anyway, today we're also joined by David Moser, who has chosen to join us mainly because of his NPR-like voice, his mild NPR-like personality. David, I ask that you today, I have one request of you, that you shock our listeners by saying something vicious or dirty or blasphemous at an entirely inappropriate moment. Would you do that for us?
Sure.
Then you can be in the club.
Then I can go back, right?
Right.
Okay.
So today we are actually going to be talking about something that comes up very often, but that we've rarely addressed directly. That is, how should we write about China? So if you live in the Anglophone world and you are not yourself closely tied to China by blood or by keen personal or professional interest, if you have not spent an inordinate amount of time here as we have or engaged in systematic academic study of China, chances are that what you believe to be true about China comes almost entirely through the lens of 100 or so individuals. These are, you know, the reporters who are stationed here in China writing on or reporting for these mainstream English language outlets. So it seems clear to me, at least, that it should be useful to know something about how these people decide what constitutes news, how they gather facts, how they find sources, how they interpret information, how they file the reporting, how it's edited for readers. You know, China, as we all know, it's an immensely complex, very dynamic, very diverse place. It's full of paradoxes. It's vexingly difficult to make intelligible to a general reading audience in the finite space of an article or a TV segment or a radio spot or even a podcast. In reporting from here, from any authoritarian country, but, you know, really particularly from this one with no tradition of free press, it has its own many, many frustrations. And, you know, I think Chinese within and outside of the party and the state feel that this Western media is inimically hostile to China. It has an agenda. It's somehow the tool of Western states that want to stymie China's rise or to throw it into turmoil. And they have not been shy about letting reporters know how they feel, either at the personal level or at the state level. And it makes it very, very difficult to report here. I mean, you send these faxes into this black hole where you never expect any kind of response. And you know, while the darker conspiracy theories and, you know, sinister machinations might be really kind of easily dismissed, no one, not least the reporters themselves, doubts that, you know, correspondents are influenced, as all humans inevitably are, by their experiences here, but also by their own values, by their own prejudices, by their own privileges. So, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, right? I mean, reporters, as long as they're aware of what these prejudices and these privileges are, as long as there's also some awareness on the part of the media consumers. I mean, if we accept, provisionally at least, that what I've said, attitudes are formed, based on a view of a very complex country through very, limited lens, I think it makes some sense that we try to understand the optical properties of that lens, right? We try to figure out what it is. China and the United States, just speaking of these two countries, this is the most important bilateral relationship in the world. I mean, and what's more is it, for Americans, you know, there's a transmission mechanism by which our beliefs about that great other, they strain and constrain policy choices in the hands of our leaders, of our policymakers. So it really does matter. So, I mean, if you look at the American reporters in China, I mean, let's be honest here. They're pretty homogenous group. I mean, they're not particularly diverse, right? I mean, these guys are, you know, overwhelmingly male or overwhelmingly in their 30s through their 50s. They're overwhelmingly the product of elite universities. They're overwhelmingly, you know, white. And, I mean, or when they're not, they're like me. They're descendants of East Asian immigrants. And I can only think of a very small number of African Americans. There's, you know, Howard French, of course, and Keith Richburg, Marsha Cook from CBS. But actually, they're not. None of them are here anymore either. I mean, it's hard. And David Barboza from the New York Times is about the only one I can think of who's here. I mean, Carlos Tejada, only Hispanic one I can think of. It's a pretty, you know, unless you count Jewish people as a minority. a large percentage of them also do not read Chinese. And even among those who do, it's the rare reporter who can read it fast, who can read it with comprehension, at least like they would in English. They're not going to be able to grasp the subtle and sophisticated arguments made by, you know, Chinese intellectuals. And they're not necessarily going to have full context, historical context. Again, I should add that there's been plenty of really, really good reporting produced by people without great Chinese skills. I mean, you think of a guy like Gadi Epstein, right? Great reporter. His Chinese isn't great. It'd be hard to argue, though, that, you know, there is limitation that can produce distortions in reporting, right? So I think most of us China watchers would agree, and I've met a few who don't, but I think they're in the minority, that one of our very best writers on China for many years has been Peter Hessler, and earlier this month in the New York Review of Books, another one of our very best writers on China, Ian Johnson, wrote a piece looking at Peter Hessler, his work, its reception in China, his ideas about how we should write about China. So we welcome Ian Johnson today to the show to talk about his piece and to talk about our friend Pete. Ian, how are you, man?
Pretty good, thanks.
Sorry for that ridiculously long preamble, but...
No, it's good.
Ian, you know Pete really well, right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, it's been, well, we met him probably around the same time, like 2000.
Yeah, sometime around then.
99, 2000. Yeah. And when he was just, you know, like the world's most overqualified clipper working for the Wall Street Journal, right? Just off his stint at the Peace Corps.
Right. No, exactly. He had come here because he knew he wanted to write books, basically, and wanted a job that would keep him in touch with the news, but wouldn't consume too much of his time.
Yeah, so smart choice.
I can remember at the time the journal was trying to get him to write more for the journal, to do articles, and he didn't want that because he knew very clearly that he didn't want to get sucked into daily journalism.
So instead, you guys basically screwed around with like the fart machine, hiding it in people's. I remember you guys doing
that.
There were things like that. You guys
wasn't the dominant narrative. I would.
Oh, it was. Come on. So how would you characterize his ideas about how one ought to write about China? I mean, if you had to just sort of in broad strokes talk about.
Well, I think he looks at it, he's trying to look at it from a very 36,000 foot perspective or whatever it is, 40,000 foot or something like that.
I think just go 30,000. Yeah.
30,000 as long as it's not a German wings plane. But anyways, I think he's saying, what are the big trends shaping China and what are the very... What's the long-term direction that China is heading? And I think he tried to find stories that would illustrate this trend. So for him, for example, the clearest thing I can say where he would take took a contrarian point of view were dissidents. He was in China reporting and living at the time that people like Liu Xiaobo were free and didn't bother to look them up. I mean, wouldn't have been against it, but I don't think he saw those people as particularly important to China's future. And I think that, of course, that's really the opposite tact of what most journalists did. I mean, most journalists, if they had the opportunity, they would try their hardest to meet Liu Xiaobo or any people like that. But Pete thought, yeah, those guys are noble. They've got great ideas. But ultimately, for China's long-term development, they're probably not going to influence things all that much.
So instead, he kind of focused his lens on the little guy. Right? He tended, I mean, I would say if there was one failing, I mean, I don't want to call it a failing. There's one thing that I mean, he is one of our best and one of our brightest. And it sometimes frustrates me that he looked almost always at these often illiterate or very low level of literacy people, often rural people rather than urban people, often sort of the downtrodden, and not with an eye toward, you know, some kind of narrative of repression or anything like that, but, you know, to find what was noble and what was good in them. And that's very laudable. But what you never did find with him is, you know, whether it was a dissident intellectual or a mainstream intellectual, he never sort of turned his gaze to try to unpack what's inside the mind of a well-educated, quite thoughtful, quite philosophical Chinese person. And I feel like that's one of the great things that we're missing.
Yeah, I mean, I think he thought, what's the most dramatic story in China? And it's that people's lives are changing so much. And that you get somebody, I mean, it wasn't the poorest of the poor, but he was looking typically at a third tier, fourth tier city resident person whose life had incredible narrative arc. Within 2 or 3 years would go from being a factory worker to a manager or something like that, or a farmer whose life was being upended by the Three Gorges Dam. But he didn't see these people as really victims, but having a lot of agency. And I think that's something he really thought that the economic reforms had really empowered people and had given them a chance to change their lives for the first time in you know, maybe a century or something. People were in control of their lives more than events were in control of people.
You almost could change to a feminine pronoun there and have been describing his wife, Leslie Chang, and her work. I mean, it's the same thing. It's sort of
true.
You can also tie in here Michael Meyer.
Sure.
Who we had on the podcast recently, who says very similar things.
Yep.
He eschews the interview with the dissident for the same reasons.
Yeah. And I think Pete had a big influence on how a lot of people.
It's not that Pete Hessler or Michael Meyer or Leslie Chang object to other people writing about Liu Xiaobo, right?
I
mean, that's just not their thing. And Kaiser, I mean, to address your point about, you know, regretting that Peter Hessler didn't engage more with sort of more sophisticated people. I mean, I think if you do engage with more sophisticated people, you are eventually going to have to write about Ai Weiwei and Liu Xiaobo, because if you don't, you're missing something. There's something missing from the story. I mean, if you're going to talk about the life of the mind, how can you not ultimately eventually write about dissidents?
Liu Xiaobo, I would agree there.
Well, yeah, I think you're right, Jeremy, but I think he would say, and Mike and other people would say, sure, that wasn't our thing. Other people could write about Liu Xiaobo and Ai Weiwei. But I think there's a little bit more. I think he thought those people ultimately were not the story in China. I may be putting a little too fine a point on it, but I think he thought those guys are ultimately irrelevant. And this is not the Soviet Union. This is not Vaclav Havel, who's issuing Charter 77, these guys are not going to become president of China or something like that. They may, in the very, very long term, have an impact. And when, as China changes, more people may discover them. But right now, it's true. You go out on the street, and there are not people clamoring to read this the way there were people clamoring to read the classic dissidents of the Soviet Union. There's no Zamizdat publications that people really care about. Yeah, some people get VPNs and read this, but 99.9% of the people don't really care about them. And I think that's his point.
If there's anyone they ever cared about, it would be Han Han. Right.
Somebody like that, right? Yeah, right.
We do clamor to read Pete Hessler's books, though. They have an incredible appeal and a very, very broad one. And I mean, it's really, truly rare that we don't meet somebody who would include him among the very best contemporary writers on China. I certainly do. What's his appeal? Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's the same question. Do we have another? This is sort of an interesting phenomenon with a Chinese audience for a China watcher. Do we have another example?
Yeah, I want to go into that in a second, but I want to talk first about his appeal to
Chinese people.
I want to first talk about the appeal to us, to people who are amateur or enthusiastic amateurs like I am.
Well, I think, I'm not sure about people in Beijing, but say the readers who have bought his books in large quantities in the United States, who have made him probably the best-selling author on China in decades and decades. I think he explains China. He gives a view of China that you don't often get in the foreign press. It's the story of these kind of small people and their this country coming of age, this country rising up. And I think it, on some deep level, it makes sense to people, because if China were this messed up country with all of these problems, then it would just be a big North Korea, right? It wouldn't be this rising power that, and whether you like it or hate it, whether you think the country is the next enemy of the United States or not, it wouldn't be in this position if it were as messed up as you sometimes read about it in the foreign press. So I think it connected with readers on that level. Like, yeah, that's why they're making all this stuff in Walmart, because those people are really hardworking. They're really smart.
Well, then it suggests to me that are the not Pete Hustlers, the not Leslie Chang's, the not Mike Myers who are writing on, are we somehow failing then to connect with it? I mean, because, you know, we do have this conspicuous gap. I mean, like I said in my lengthy preamble, they see China through the lens of this 100-odd people, and the what you come away with is scratching your head and wondering, why isn't the country in full tilt revolt then?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the easy way is to sort of say it's all complementary, and that the Hustlers of the world provide X and other people provide the Y. It's the yin and the yang of the China story. I think there's something there, but I do think there is a tension between these two viewpoints. And I think you do find a lot of people in the foreign press corps who sort of will say, you know, when's Hustler going to tackle a real topic? Like, when's he going to write a book on the environment or on some, you know, big issue type thing? Without realizing that his stories often did touch on very, very, or the ultimately really big issues.
Certainly, Oracle Bones did, yeah.
Oracle Bones, or even Country Driving.
Even Country Driving,
you know, factories, yeah. How factories, business is organized in China, and stuff like that. But I still think there's this feeling that maybe those aren't the real stories. Like, you got to have a really big issue with a sort of summary paragraph in the fourth paragraph of the article that says, this symbolizes, this illustrates, blah, 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 about China. Mm. And his stories didn't really have that.
I mean, maybe this is a little bit off topic, but I think it bears mention that he has a very particular narrative voice and a very particular style of writing. I mean, it's I've not read the Chinese translations, and that's what I want to talk about next is, you know, how he has been read in China. But I wonder whether his kind of stripped down, his unadorned short sentence prose style. I mean, I remember a journalist woman who used to date him who once mockingly called him Hemingway boy.
Boy. Well, I think he's got a great writing style. And that's another thing where I think he wanted to avoid journalism, because one of the things about journalism, which I have to, you know, admit is true, is that journalism, it demands economy of writing. It demands an economy in the sense, also efficiency more than anything. And journalists tend to write in a lot of cliches. They have very formulaic ways of telling stories, and it drills the voice out of you. So that you write X style. You can write in Times style or Wall
Economist
Street Journal
style
Bloomberg style, and get that done as quickly as possible on deadline and hack out the story in an hour if need be, because sometimes you have to do that. But really great writing is not like that. Really great writing, there is a recognizable voice, and you don't learn that in journalism.
Yeah.
So what's won him such a readership in China is what I'm – I guess this is a – before we get into the whole topic of this debate where, loosely speaking, him and Evan Osnos, his successor at the New Yorker as China correspondent here, took very different takes on this. But let's talk about the reasons for his appeal in China, because I – just today, I mean, in a completely unrelated thing, I was answering a question on Quora by a young journalist – or aspiring journalist here in China. I mean, he lives in, I can't remember what, in Nanjing. And he was asking, you know, how do I break into the English language profession of journalism? And I looked at his question, and he noted that he writes an English language blog. I clicked on the link, and one of his first stories is about his unbridled admiration for Peter Hustler. I said, wow, you know, it's funny. I'm actually going to record a podcast about this topic tonight. And there it was. What Ian, maybe Jeremy, you can throw in on here too. What is the appeal?
Well, I mean, I think it's actually more complex. The American readers, you can sort of summarize in a couple of sentences. I think in China, he touches on a bunch of things. I think because, first of all, people are thrilled that you can read a big name observer about China in Chinese, that his books have been translated. And let's face it, most foreign journalists' books have not been translated. I think also his empathy and sympathy for people, which Paul Cohen, the Harvard historian, described in an amazing sort of 21-page article in the Journal of Asian Studies. I think this really comes through, this being able to see the sort of good side of what's going on. I think people appreciate that. You know, it's, after all, it is their country, and you don't want to have people stomping on your country all the time. Even if all these other books could be translated, a lot of people might sort of take issue with the way China is portrayed. And I think we feel the same way about our own countries. You know, when foreign observers come and write about our countries, we're always happy about de Tocqueville because he discovered democracy and civil society. And, wow, he was a French guy who really got it. And this guy's...
230 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and, you know, this guy still is selling. He's got royalty checks coming. You know, right. But, you know,
I think that's absolutely the case. I think Peter Hessler manages to be sympathetic without being a stoogey or propagandistic, which a lot of writing that's sympathetic to China and the Chinese government tends to be. You know, you don't come away from his works feeling that he is in any sense any kind of 50 center. I would from my own personal experience, before my old blog Danwei got blocked and I became a anti-China force, we had quite a lot of Chinese fans, and the reason people would write us fan mail, and it was a similar kind of thing. There was an appreciation of the fact that we were writing and translating Chinese voices and sort of commenting on them from a point of view that was different from the average Chinese person, but was extremely sympathetic. So I think that is a big part of it.
Absolutely.
I was struck by something in the article also, that one of the Chinese fans...
You know what I realized before? Is that we didn't ID the article correctly. I mean, we didn't tell that it's in the New York Review of Books. Unfortunately, it's paywalled.
Only for another month. Then it'll be on the China File website. Unpaywall.
And it's got the terrific title of An American Hero in China.
Yeah, I didn't write that.
No, it really does. It's really called An American Hero in China. And Ian, please, you know, explain that you had no... exculpate yourself here.
I didn't, but they often write kind of funny, jokey headlines.
Was there irony intended, or was there something... I mean, was it...
I don't know. He's kind of... I mean, to a lot of people, he is a hero, right? Like that guy who talked to you. Amazingly, the number of people who showed up at his book signings waited hours in line to get a signature. And he sells an incredible number. 500,000 books sold in China in 4 years.
Jesus.
It's amazing.
And these David, I'm sorry. I interrupted you, though.
Right. Well, one of the comments of the Chinese fans was they said... he will sometimes just notice things we never notice. Like he just takes one of those big character propaganda posters that are all over town, and most Chinese never even look at them. They never even registers cognitively, and he just translates it without even any criticism or commentary. And people say, that was the first time I've ever really noticed what that character said, what that poster said. And when you read it in translation, literally, it's very funny. It's strange. It makes me think. So I think a lot of it is the novelty, just the sheer novelty of seeing another viewpoint on your culture, another eye that lets you see it for the first time. I mean, you know, it's very hard to see what's right in front of your nose.
Ian, I'm curious, has Peter told you what he thought of that piece that you wrote on him?
I think we have slightly different views on censorship and what you are willing to put up with to have your book published in China, which maybe we'll get to a little bit later. But I think overall he thought it was okay, fine. I mean, I didn't run it. I don't know. I think, yeah. Not sure. I don't think you liked the headline.
No, I don't think I like the headline.
Can I also just suggest one other feature of Peter Hessler's writing that makes him popular both with Western readers and Chinese is that he writes good. I mean, writing is
his
good.
I don't think
that
crazy envious
ignored.
Yeah, yeah, I have to agree. I mean, he's just stylistically he's just terrific, and I usually don't like that sort of short, choppy writing. He just does it extremely well. He's good. It's a very masculine style, very well chosen nouns and verbs, and very slight use of adverbs and other descriptors. Anyway, I want to save this censorship topic for a little while, but I want to still talk about how we write on China. I was on a panel very recently in Shanghai with a very well known journalist James Fallows, Jim Fallows, who spent a lot of time living here in China. And we were talking, as one does, about the problem of the restrictions that have been imposed on journalism recently, and how I described them as an own goal. I thought that was, it was just, it's sheer idiocy to do this. It's so self-defeating that it just sort of, you know, shabby treatment generates, and let's be honest, it does, tends to generate a higher percentage of negative stories among all stories written. And it just sort of keeps that spiral going, which, you know, which begets more shabby treatment, which begets more nasty writing. And Jim said something that I thought was terrific. He said, the cure for that is let 100 times the number of you know, issue 100 times as many J visas as you have. I mean, you know, if you had lots and lots of people here and they can't all be writing the same story, they will find the other stories to write. And he said, any reasonable person who comes to China and has their eyes open and isn't completely blinkered is going to realize that there is an awful lot that this country has gotten right in the last 35 years. That you know, a reasonable person is going to recognize that the country's transformation has been quite mind-boggling, and I emphatically agree. Problem is that, you know, when people have limited time, a limited number of stories that they can file, I mean, they're going to go with the jailed rights lawyers and the dissidents, the persecuted religious groups, the horrific environmental degradation, the political infighting, and so forth. The infrastructure boondoggles, the whatever. I mean, you know, it's always going to be the negative stuff.
But part of it, you know, is because just you were saying at the beginning that there's almost not enough competency about China, but there's almost in some ways too many China specialists, because there's so many people who come here blinkered and have only been to China. And it's the only country they've been to outside of, say, the United States or their home country. And they don't realize how things work in the rest of the developing world. I remember when I was here in the 90s, Roan Tempest was here with the LA Times, and his stationing before here was India. And we would all say, oh, God, this is really a disaster in China. And he said, well, you know, I think it's bad here. You should see what it's like in India. You think the Chunyun is bad here, or the moving of people Diwali back for the Spring Festival. It's like 20 times worse in India. And we thought at first he was a little bit nutty. But with time, you begin to realize that as you travel and see things around the world. But there's so many people who just have not been elsewhere. Mm. And
good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very fair. I mean, it's something that my good friend Ada Shen has brought up before. There seems to be this tendency to compare Chinese realities to American intentions. I'm not sure that's sort of how – I don't know. I'm sure I'm guilty of it as well. I mean, there's this sort of faith in the self-corrective mechanisms, you know, in the American polity, and you know, anything that we see is just – It's a sure sign of the fundamental fragility of authoritarianism. It's broken. The institutions don't exist, and you know, everything's fucked.
I'm really with Fallows, though. I think that's a great point. I mean, about letting 100 like flowers bloom in a certain way, because you know, part of the problem is, I mean, to take a sort of broader sort of Buddhist kind of perspective, I mean, you really need all kinds attacking the.
He's in lotus position.
I am actually. Yeah. You need all kinds of people looking at China from all different angles, including the human rights angle. I mean, you don't want to do without but you need people that are exploring it in, you know, nuanced ways and other ways. And it's the only way you can do that is by throwing more people at it. And, you know, one thing that does supplement it a little bit is the blogs, such as danwei.org, as it was at the time, and then other ones now. Jeremy, yes?
Yeah, I agree. I think the other thing is that, I mean, I used to say that the last people living in a totalitarian China were foreign correspondents, because they were being, you know, forced to live in a kind of segregated situation and followed around, having their phones tapped, etc. And, you know, maybe that's changed under the chairman of everything, Xi Jinping. You know, there are a lot of other people who are having a tough time. But I mean, the way that the Chinese authorities deal with foreign journalists, ranging from, you know, surveillance to having thugs rough them up in, you know, when they try and report on horrible things going on in the provinces, doesn't help, because it encourages a mindset where you are much more, the journalist is much more inclined to write about the horrible things the Chinese government is doing, because they are experiencing, you know, some of them themselves. So I think that is another area where, China could change the narrative by actually being nicer to foreign journalists.
Poor guy. Great.
Yeah, that's going to be hard. I mean, there's a bunch of things, of course. There's no point going into all of them. But one of the easiest things also would be just for the government to talk more, to get interviews with government officials. It's almost impossible. Sometimes you don't know what their views are, and they can be perfectly reasonable even sometimes. I mean, the goals could be perfectly reasonable, or there could be a good point of view that they have. You just never get it. And then you have
I'm just waiting for them to tap me. I'm just waiting for them. I'm waiting for a long time. I don't understand. I mean,
they're not going to tap them.
The chief soft power officer.
Yes, right, exactly.
You know, one of the things that I think this has generated an awful lot of debate. Not long ago, Pete wrote a story. I mean, and it started before that. He wrote a story in the New Yorker called "Travels with My Censor." Ian, do you want to talk a little bit about that? And I'm sure that was, you know, the sort of in the background for, of. You probably wrote this actually before that piece came out.
I wrote my piece last year, and it just sat around, actually.
Okay, okay.
Until his piece ran, and then they were like, oh, holy smokes.
But let's go with that. I mean, you know, because that the voice is the same voice, right? We're talking, I mean, he's really talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think he shows his censor. He's not really a censor. He's the editor at the publishing house, and he also is in charge of cutting stuff that will get the publishing house into trouble, so you could call him a censor. But he shows him in a very humane light, and how his grandfather committed suicide in the Cultural Revolution, and this incredible arc that this guy's life and his family had been through, and here he was now trying to get edgy titles on, you know, Mexican poverty or whatever, published in China, the kind of books that will make people in China think about their own country. And so I think he showed him in a very humane light, and probably in a way that is a little more useful than the sort of cartoonish figure of, you know, some evil guy, the censor with a big pair of scissors or something like that, just butchering copy. I mean, not that those people don't exist also, but.
And so this was part of a pretty, you know, a pervasive dialogue. I mean, everyone in the China watching community was, you know, I'm pro Hessler, I'm pro Osnos in this. Maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but, you know, they did come down with you know, a different take. After all, Age of Ambition, which is it's just been shortlisted for a Pulitzer and has already won the National Book Award for nonfiction, that book, Evan, you know, very pointedly decided he was not going to have translated because the guy with the big scissors would
take out a quarter. Yeah,
would take out a quarter of the book. Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, no, and I think
First of all, do you think this is a false dichotomy, or do you think that there's actually common ground between them? And it's just a matter of, you know, how much of these books would have been. I mean, after all, you know, Pete didn't have Oracle Bones published.
Right. No, I think realistically, Evan's book could never have been published. So in a way, there was a bit of a false tension in that piece that he wrote for the New York Times saying, well, my censor, I approached, you know, the censors were going to cut too much, so I wasn't going to publish it. I mean, you know, ahead of time, a book that has Ai Weiwei and Cheng Guangzhou and all that, that's not going to be published in China. So I think that sort of thing is. But it's a legitimate point that he makes, though, I think, because when you look at these books that are published in China, you sometimes wonder, well, how much of the book is really there?
Yeah.
And if the interesting, edgy parts of the book are taken out, then are you giving people a pablumized, sanitized version of Hessler's works or somebody else's works, or are you giving them the real thing? So, you know, if you go to the San Lian bookstore or some bookstore in China, you see all these fascinating titles and you think, wow, China's really open. But if they've all gone through the blender a little bit, then you wonder, you know, what's been lost.
Well, sometimes you document that, right, in that article. There are also lots of examples. I've spent many of the past years doing just exactly that, comparing the Chinese translations with the English, with biographies of Mao, and also Ezra Vogel's biography of Deng Xiaoping, right, which is very clear what was excised. And if you look at that sort of thing, especially the biography of Mao, if you look, usually they expunge the naughty parts that have to do with Mao's sex life. But almost everything else is left in.
Yeah,
they don't need that because everyone already knows.
Right. Yeah. So, but the point is, it's the similar kind of thing with Vogel's biography of Deng Xiaoping, for example. I mean, there were certain things excised, but what the reader got was a very broad, different sort of take on Deng Xiaoping from a foreign observer. And what was taken out, I don't think certainly it was such a huge book. What was in there, what was left in there, matters more than the few mentions of Tiananmen or something that were taken out. But that gets to the, you know, as you said, maybe it's a false dichotomy. It's every case you have to look on a case-by-case basis. depending on what kind of book it is and how much it's going to get
there is
butchered.
something though, like if you think your book is a work of art and you really view yourself as a writer, like a novelist or something like that, then taking out 2% of it is still taking out something from the work, right? So there is something there that I can see where even small cuts can weaken. Now, if your goal is more like, I'm getting a new viewpoint, a new information over to Chinese people that they otherwise didn't have, then yeah, if I lose 10% of the book, who cares? I mean, I'm getting 90% of it through. But it really, I guess, I can see both sides of it, actually.
So could I. I mean, in fact, I tend to see that second side of it more. I mean, after all, I work at a search engine that is obliged to censor, and I sleep fine at night knowing that we are doing what we can to expand the information horizons of ordinary Chinese people. This is the same thing that Google said when they came in 2006.
Right.
They said,
right,
this may not be full fulfillment of the mission, but it is in the direction of the mission, you know, and I respect, admire, and agree with that.
Yeah, that's what Joseph Escherich said. He in this part of this debate also, he's a historian who had a book that came out recently, and he had to work with the censors extensively to go and cut stuff and then fighting it also and trying to get one word put back or whatnot. And he felt that it was all worth it in the end. But it is tricky, and it really does depend on the book, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't think that people tend to criticize the people who go along with it as sort of giving up the moral arc there, the moral aspect that you shouldn't even, you know, even 0.1% is too much. But I don't know. I mean, I can see that. I can certainly see that side of it also.
Ian, you've published a book in about China, of course, and it was a very, very well-received book. A professor friend of mine at Duke, Ralph Litzinger, was talking about how of all books that he teaches, that's the one that is the most, generates just the most enthusiasm from his students. And of course, that's Wild Grass. And talk about what your decisions were in.
Oh, well, with my book, there was no doubt it wasn't going to be published because about a third of it is on Falun Gong.
Right.
So that didn't even factor into it. It's published in Taiwan, but I wouldn't expect that book will ever be published. I think there's a book I wrote on Islam and the Cold War in Europe, and that book I think might be published in China in the future. And I think, you know, there China can. Well, probably has interesting things they can learn from it, perhaps about Xinjiang and so on. But there's nothing about China. I don't think they'll cut much about it or anything.
There is a concept. Eric Abrahamson, the founder of Paper Republic and a literary translator, he coined the term, I think he called it tweaking, which refers to the subtle self-censorship or censorship of people speaking about China at public events and also in books and articles that get translated, which has the negative effect of not giving people an idea of exactly how differently other people might look at China. And I think that is, I mean, that is one of the problems with it. So I find it difficult to say, you know, I think the black and white view is too extreme that you know, even 0.001% censorship to publish in China is completely unacceptable, but it's still problematic.
Well, great, guys. Time is getting away from us, and we do need to get to recommendations. Any parting thoughts on any of this? Anything that you feel, Ian, that we haven't really gotten to? That I mean, it's a terrific piece. I hope that once that paywall goes up, everyone's going to rush in and read the thing.
No, I would just say, one thing that strikes me is that we often talk about how foreign journalists talk in stereotypes about China.
Sure.
It's not just about China. You know, having worked in Germany for many years, I can tell you that if you could get the word Nazi in the first paragraph, your story was much, much more likely to get on page one than if you couldn't. And so we had sort of like the Nazi rule for a while at the Wall Street Journal. If you couldn't get Nazi in the story, you weren't going to get on page one.
Wow.
So,
Jesus.
You know,
it's that bad, huh?
It
it's funny. I mean, because now, I mean, it seems to be like if you aren't drawing some sort of parallel to the Cultural Revolution from what's happening right now in the Xi Jinping era, I mean, if you're not talking about any pronouncement in terms of the Yan'an Forum, you know, on culture, if you're not talking about everything that he does in terms of you know, the erection of a personality cult, then it's like, anyway. Right. You know,
what have a personality cult? Anyways.
Ian, you're such a... Anyway, I do want to move on to recommendations. Great. One final question for all of you. Go around and tell me, what's your favorite Peter Hessler book? David?
It's still Rivertown, I'd have to say.
Ian?
I think I kind of like Strange Stones because it has my favorite story in it, which is the story of the family that's being flooded out by the by the Three Gorges Dam, and they build a boat just like Noah, and they float away. And he has all these sort of biblical allusions in the writing. It's just a great little story.
Strange Stones, though, I mean, I felt sort of the same way I felt with Evan's book, that I'd read all this already.
It was patchwork.
A little bit too much. A great book. I know that coming to this fresh, I would just love it. But, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Jeremy, your favorite work by
Peter? It has to be Country Driving, which enraged me when I first read it, because I'd been driving around the countryside in many of some of the places and picking some of the same things. And I was like, God damn it! He did it again!
Have we somehow failed to point out also how funny he is? Yeah, I mean, that's funny. Actually one of the things that, I mean, we need to say. I mean, Meyer's great. He's funny. But his humor isn't... Pete, if you know him in person, he just does this terrific deadpan, right? I mean, that's like his style. I remember going, our friend Eric Rosenblum, his son had turned 2 or 3, and Pete showed up at his birthday party and just sort of expressionless face. Yeah, I brought my present. It's, you know, he gives him like 3 uncapped black Sharpie pens and says, yeah, this is for your son. And sorry, I lost the caps. But I mean, it was just that sort of thing that he would plan out and be able to pull off just so deadpan.
Well, one of my funniest passages I've seen from him is what it's like to be in China and to be asked about Dashan. He has this whole 2 pages about you know, going through the whole thing we've all been through. You
Not
know,
me.
Have you heard of Dashan? You know, and it's screamingly funny. I don't think Dashan found it very funny.
No, he didn't actually. I'd love to get the 2 of them. One of them might punch the other. Anyway, he's. I also love that part. I'm down with Rivertown still. I mean, having read them all, I love them all. But Rivertown for me is just so. There's this weird combination of earnestness and this kind of refreshing lack of cynicism, which I really like about Pete's writing. But it's earnest without being cloying in any way, without being maudlin or without being any. I mean, there's nothing over sentimental about it, but it's still somehow, it feels like, yeah, this is a product of the American Midwest somehow.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good point.
Enough of the love fest, and I say this about a man who I think that in court some people would say I don't have to like this guy, right? For various reasons. Anyway, recommendations. Jeremy, you start as always.
Okay, my first recommendation is sort of connected to our topic. It's a great old essay by Binyavanga Wainaina called "How to Write About Africa," and I'm just going to read the first paragraph.
Oh, good.
Always use the word Africa or darkness or safari in your title. Subtitles may include the words Zanzibar, Maasai, Zulu, Zambezi, Congo, Nile, big, sky, shadow, drum, sun, or bygone. Also useful are words such as gorillas, timeless, primordial, and tribal. Note that people means Africans who are not black, while the people means Africans. Never have a picture of a well-adjusted African on the cover of your book or in it, unless that African has won the Nobel Prize. An AK 47, prominent ribs, naked breasts. Use these. And it goes on in this vein.
But oh, yeah, that's brilliant.
How do you spell that person's last name?
Wainaina.
Okay.
So it's published by Granta, and it's on their website. It's without a paywall. And then I would like to make another recommendation, but before I do, I would like to say people should quit complaining about paywalls and just pay the fucking money to the New Yorker of your books so that they can pay fucking writers to write fucking good shit.
Okay.
So
see, you asked me to say something abusive. Jeremy will take care of that. I knew I didn't have to. It will be taken care of by him.
You need to pay your dues still, David.
And then I'm afraid I have to make another recommendation, which is go to China Media Project and read an English summary, or if your Chinese is up for it, go to the website of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and read the screed against New Qing historians.
I saw that. Jeremiah appears to have
come straight out of the Cultural Revolution.
Well, yeah, that'll put you
Mark
on the front.
Mark Elliott and Jim Millward among those denounced.
Pamela Crossley.
Jim Millward has pointed out that there are no fewer than 88 exclamation marks.
It's probably exactly 88. Basharbad's lucky, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you don't want to have like to an 87 or dumbing, 89, for heaven forbid.
The Chinese Mind under Xi Jinping, I would recommend reading that from an institution that has in the past been seen as one of the more enlightened institutions in China.
To say that one guy's idiotic screed on a CASS website is the pronouncement of the Xi Jinping administration is, to me, a little bit like, you know, that mistake that a lot of people make, that monolithic, you know, they do this all the time. It's like China bans this or China bans that, when it's been banned in some, you know, remote Western county of, you know, Sanmenxia. In, it's like, you know, Harlan County, Kentucky bans the teaching of evolution. And if you wrote headlines, it said the U.S. bans teaching of evolution. I mean, come on.
Yeah, except it's not an isolated data point. You know, it's not. It's not.
Well, neither is that Harlan County, Kentucky banning the teaching of evolution, right?
Okay, this is a topic for another podcast.
Yeah, Kentucky.
Right.
Yeah.
Ian.
Well, I just was reading and really liked four books by Yan Lian Ke, the author, the contemporary author. This is one of the first that I know of sort of major fictional treatments of the Great Leap Forward famine. And it's told in a very sophisticated way through four different narrators and their stories. Well, three actually, because there's two people have one person tells two stories. But anyways, it's a good read. It's not a long book. It's about 250 pages or so. And it's so it was unfortunately banned in China. I think that was because, according to Yan, that they sort of messed things up with the publishers and didn't quite get it out. But it's not probably anything that couldn't have been published in China. But there's a very good translation out that's just out now. And the translator is Carlos Royas, who is a really first-rate translator. And I recommend that book.
Great. Thanks. David, your turn.
Something off politics completely is Abigail Washburn and Bella Fleck's new album, just the two of them, husband and wife duo, but Abigail sings, of course.
The Emperor and Empress of the Banjo.
Yes, it's two banjos, dueling banjos, or cooperating banjos, I guess. But it's very nostalgic, it's very American, it's very folk, it's sometimes very sad. It's just a nice thing to listen to. And, by the way, Abigail Washburn has got a lot of other songs about China or in Chinese.
In Chinese, yes.
That I recommend also. And she also collaborates with a certain guzheng player who Jeremy...
I forgot her name.
Yeah, I forgot her name. The name is escaping me at the moment, yes. But very nice album. Very nice listening.
I'm going to make so people who've been maybe listening to my recommendations recently may pick up on a theme here. I have been obsessed with the old Wild and Ariel Durant Story of Civilization series. And while on occasion I'll read them, I have, you know, some of the books that I salvaged from my childhood, and, you know, I've downloaded a couple of them on Kindle. But my preferred means of digesting these things are audiobooks from one particular narrator. His name is Stefan Rudnicki, and he is the best reader. I mean, he is just a pleasure to listen to, just an intense pleasure to listen to. His pronunciation, his cadence, and you realize that Durant's works were truly meant to be read aloud. I mean, the flavor is, I shiver often. There's this 30-second, you know, repeat function on, if you've got it on your iPhone or on your iPad. There are passages which I'll just keep listening to again and again. I mean, it's so moving. So the one that I'm listening to right now is The Age of Louis the 14th, and it's unbelievable. There's just this great passage that I just finished listening to about Pascal. It's still, I'm very early on, but Pascal, oh wow, what a phenomenally great writer. I mean, just genius, just absolute genius. So read him. read
listen to him.
Yeah, listen to him. Yeah, Stefan Rudnicki. And anything he narrates is just turned to gold. It's just spectacular.
British English?
No. He's American.
Okay.
And, he's got this incredibly deep voice. I mean, no, it's gravelly and it's deep. But it's not annoying. It's not stentorian. It conveys a kind of profundity, but also, you know, levity in the writing. He captures the mood of the writing just really, really well as he reads. He's a really skilled voice actor. So, hey, thanks, guys. And I will see you all next week on Seneca Podcast. So take care.